From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Rochester in the year 2000. In that year, 38% of children in our city were living in poverty, and it was a worrying number to say the least. The National Center for Children in Poverty says the national average is 22% of American kids in poverty. So 15 years ago, Rochester's rate was far above the national average, but fast forward to today. The latest numbers show that 55% of children in Rochester are now growing up in poverty, more than double the national average, a big jump in the past decade and a half. Well, what's going on here? What are we doing, and where does it end? 80% of elementary school students in the Rochester City School District qualify for free or reduced price lunches. And then this, just 7% of Rochester third graders are meeting the standards on reading for New York State. 9% of fourth graders are passing the math exam. 4% of eighth graders are passing the English exam. There is more, and this hour we look at the 2015 Rock the Future report card for our children. Rock the Future was formed in 2011 as Rochester's Cradle to Career Collaborative, aimed at improving academic achievement for city kids. It's composed of 50 local organizations and community partners. You know many of the names. The Children's Agenda, Ibero, ABC, MCC, The United Way, and more. My guests are going to take us through the new report card and what it means for our kids. And Rock to Future's Alliance Director is Jackie Campbell. She's one of our guests. Jackie, it's nice to see you here.
Thank you.
Nice also here is Erica Rosenberg, a principal with the Center for Governmental Research. And she's going to help us work through some of the data. Erica, nice to see you.
Hi.
And Dr. Leonard Brockers is here. He's the former Rock the Future Alliance Director, and you've heard his voice on this program in recent weeks because he is the head of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. No small task for you, Leonard. It's nice to see you back here.
It's good to be here.
All right, Erica, I'm going to hope that we're going to find some spots in the data to be encouraged. And there are some, right?
That's right, especially in the realm of some of the things we track regarding early childhood. There definitely have been some gains. One of the things we were really excited to talk about last week at the big breakfast on this subject was the rate of pre-kindergartners, rate of four-year-olds, actually, who are now having a pre-kindergarten experience before they go to kindergarten. So in the city of Rochester, we are very close to sort of universal coverage, which is really important, especially when we're talking about the student population that you're talking about, that many of them are not having the experiences in the early years that really get kids ready for school. So that pre-kindergarten year is critical. There's been a dedicated band of people in our community who've been working on quality pre-K since long before Rock the Future started, doing their own collective impact initiative before we called it that. And they're really responsible for spreading the growth of quality pre-K programs, of tracking the quality level in those programs, and increasingly of expanding access for four-year-olds and now moving to even get more three-year-olds involved in the program. So I think that's definitely something hopeful.
All right, so I'm looking at, you provide the data from 2013, mm-hmm. 2014, and 2015. So enrolled in pre-K went from 75% 2 years ago, no change last year, 75%. 95% this year. So that's what you say when you say near universal, 95%.
Yeah, and let me just take us back a little further than that and some other data that I have. So back in 2001, it was 31%.
Wow.
So we're talking about really, really strong gains. And I should mention just as a little geeky caveat that we do include in that number when we're talking about 95, 96% for the most recent year, kids who are in Head Start. So it's kids who are in universal pre-K and kids who are in Head Start. We actually don't count kids who are in private preschool, paying for pre-kindergarten on their own, only because no one keeps track of that.
Okay, and so Jackie Campbell, I'm looking at this number. It might be the single most encouraging number in the entire report mm-hmm. card. When we talk about near universal kids in pre-K at the age of four, and as Erica said, more in three. And to some degree, Jackie, do you think that the 2020 report card and the 2025 report card are going to be impacted by the fact that the 3 and 4 year olds in our city are finally getting at a much higher level, that early intervention, the education, because we're going to work through some of the other numbers, and as we get older, it's not as encouraging. But are we now setting the groundwork for better numbers?
Oh, I definitely believe so. And so if you move out to 2020, one of the things that we are expecting to see is that more of those students that are in pre-K right now actually being able to impact that third grade reading mark. So we're trying to do the things that we can now to lay the foundation so that when they get to that important grade level where they're beginning to, where they're changing from learning how to read and going into reading to learn, mm-hmm. that they're able to actually meet what we expect of them and what we want for them.
And we always hear, boy, if you're not reading by third grade, you're in real trouble. The outcomes, the numbers, the data is not good.
Absolutely.
And we'll get there in a second here. Leonard, what do you think of that pre-K number? How important is that to you as someone who's worked with Rock the Future and now leading the Anti-Poverty Initiative?
Absolutely. So early child support is directly correlated with later school success. So like Jackie Campbell made reference, to have, an increase in the number of students that are participating in universal pre-kindergarten as well as Head Start, it increases the likelihood and the probability that they would be able to read at grade level by third grade and be able to meet the benchmarks that are identified within the Rock the Future Park card as they continue to build out their trajectory from cradle to career.
All right, so there you go, 95%. And by the way, Erica Rosenberg, on that number, is it achievable? I have no idea what other cities are doing with pre-K. Obviously, 95% sounds great. Mm-hmm. Is it achievable to do even better? Can you get roughly to 98, 99, 100%?
I think so. But I will say, to put it in context, I think Rochester's doing far better than most cities. In the suburbs, the numbers aren't anything like this, and the need is probably not as great either. But in the cities that would be more comparable to Rochester, I'm not sure that anybody gets this close.
Okay. And this has just been a priority choice, right? So that's why we go back to 2001, 31%, 95% now. That's just prioritization.
In part. I mean, there was a state initiative in the late 90s, a statewide universal pre-K initiative. So that has something to do with why we have UPK all over the state. But certainly locally, there's been a particular focus and a lot of efforts and some real champions in the community. Leonard wants to jump in.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why there's such a there's so much attention given to pre-K is because a lot of young people were entering the K-12 system developmentally behind. So the earlier you can engage young people in developmental support, it doesn't necessarily eliminate the gap that exists, but if you go into the K-12 system with a significant gap, from that point forward, it continues to widen. So there's a significant need to emphasize young people participating, or at least families participating in early child support.
And so just to back that up a little bit more, and Jackie may want to speak to this more, but another priority that Rock the Future has had over the last couple of years is even reaching kids at a younger age to try to identify those with developmental problems and address them. So a big additional win this year was a large grant that has been awarded to expand screenings among three-year-olds, because there is kind of this gulf in, what we're able to track, and really more important than being able to track it, being able to identify the kids that need help, because problems that are addressed early can sometimes be fully remediated, so that kids, things like hearing problems, vision problems, these are things that sometimes aren't identified until kindergarten. And if they're not identified until kindergarten, kids have fallen way behind by that time.
Right. Let me ask Jackie and Leonard one more brief follow-up on the question of pre-K, because in recent weeks, as we've looked at the early findings from the Rochester-Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, one of the big points, one of the big problems is simply transportation. So for people in poverty, getting transportation to work. But also, I would assume, getting transportation of your 3 or 4-year-old to pre-K. It looks like it's happening, and I'm totally ignorant of this, but I just want to make sure that we're clear. I mean, they're getting the help they need. Kids are obviously getting there, it sounds like.
These are schools that exist within the neighborhood, as well as the Head Start Centers. The ABC is a neighborhood-based organization. So transportation is not a barrier, because these are neighborhood-based opportunities that young people and families could take advantage of. So transportation doesn't serve as a barrier as it relates to these.
Is it 95% enrolled? I mean, we don't know what the actual attendance is. How many kids are there? Is that fair to say, Erica?
Yeah, that's right. It's enrolled.
All right. So we certainly hope that of the 95% that it's regular attendance. Jackie, any thoughts on that before we continue there?
Only that we know that kids do better when they are actually in the seat, and so there is the same emphasis on attendance at the universal pre-K level as there is in school.
Absolutely. Okay, and then the other number where we did see a smaller uptick, but an uptick nonetheless, was in early prenatal care. Going back to 2013, 68%. Had early prenatal care, then 69% last year, 72% this year. Anything else I should know about the data there, Erica? I mean, that's just a...
Just that reflects a pretty steady rise from even lower percentages going back further in time. So we do have a good incline in the right direction on that one.
Okay, and again, panel, is that simply because we're prioritizing prenatal care more than we used to? And Leonard, you're nodding. Yes?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, the 72% rate that you cited for the city of Rochester is still below the county level and the state level, and that is a number that, you know, there's an aspect of Rock the Future that's working on that as well, and that definitely is something we should be continuing to prioritize because we should get better than that.
Yeah, we know prenatal care and pre-K enrollment, two huge issues, and again, those numbers trending in a better direction. Now, ready for school. How do we define what ready for school means? Let me start there.
Yeah. So there's an assessment that we've used in our community in the universal pre-K world now for a few years called the Brigance assessment. There are other assessments that have been used as well, but the experts have kind of settled on this Brigance assessment. I think it assesses kids in a variety of domains, social literacy, some other things I'm not thinking of right now, and then just tries to say whether or not they are sort of roughly on track, because again, the other thing to keep in mind, we're talking about young children, is that they don't all develop at exactly the same rate. So we don't look at a kid who's 3 or 4 or 4.5 and, you know, have this harsh benchmark where we say, nope, they're absolutely not ready for school. But there is an assessment where we can say that kids look like they're pretty much on track or that they might have some serious problems.
Okay. And the number, the ready for school number, that number not available 2 years ago, 2014, the report card showed 2/3, roughly 66%. And that number, 64% this time around.
Yeah, and those are kids in universal pre-K. And there's actually, they do the assessment, I think, at two times. So at the beginning of their pre-K year and the end of their pre-K year. So we may have some students, it's a small share now, though, who are going to kindergarten and not being in universal pre-K. So they're not included in that number. But one of the things we do see with that number is that there's a big gain, as you would expect and hope, over the pre-K year, that they're far more are ready for kindergarten at the end than were at the beginning.
Okay. Listeners, as we work through this report card from Rock the Future, if you have any questions or comments about what you're hearing, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Rock the Future Alliance Director Jackie Campbell is here. Dr. Leonard Brock's here, the former Rock the Future Alliance Director, and now the head of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. And Erica Rosenberg from the Center for Governmental Research is helping us work through these numbers on this brand new report card. Okay, let's go down to chronically absent. And I want to make sure I'm interpreting this correctly. It doesn't look like it's too complicated. But so K to 3, the target... I see target in there, mm-hmm. but what's the target, Erica?
Yeah. So the school district has been prioritizing this problem for a number of years, and one of the ways they did it is by picking the schools, elementary schools, with the lowest attendance to try to make a difference in. So that's what we mean when we refer to the K-3 target schools. And chronic absence, I just want to mention, is defined as kids missing 10% or more of the school year. And the reason we talk about attendance in these terms now is that we used to look at average daily attendance rates for schools, and you can actually have a pretty high average daily attendance. You can be at 85, 90, 90, even over 90%, but have a significant share of students who are missing a lot of school. It's sort of masked in that larger number. So we now look at how many kids are missing a lot of school.
And that's at least one day every 2 weeks, and that's a lot of school when you think about that. Chronically absent, so you went from last year 47% chronically absent in the K-3 target schools.
That's right.
To 37% this year. So 47% to 37%. Mm-hmm. K-3 district wide, mm-hmm. is that right?
Yes.
37% to 30% this year.
Yep.
And K-12 district wide, 38% 2 years ago, 35% chronically absent this time. Leonard, you've been with Rock the Future, and I'm curious to know, first of all, what do you think is working here?
Yeah, I do believe the blitzes and the community engagement process that allows for community members to engage families and, I guess, some advocate for the importance of school is leading to these positive gains. The school district has been a pioneer or a front runner in this work, and I know that it was the school district just most recently was cited and referenced across the country for the unique gains that we're receiving as it relates to The reduction of chronic absence students. So we're following best practices. We're following Every Minute Matters, I want to say, was an effort in New York City for which we modeled a lot of our work after. And Jerome Underwood, who's leading the charge with the city school district with respects to this initiative, he, I, Dirk Hightower, and several others participated with Annie Casey in a training for which this work was highlighted. So I'm glad to see that we're trending in the right direction. I do believe that this is one of the bright spots, or at least one of the promising practices that we could cite as being positive in the city school district.
You think most kids want to be in school every day, Leonard?
Do I think most? Yeah.
That's a tricky question.
I don't necessarily think that elementary age student would not want to go to school.
I agree.
Yes, young people enjoy.
Talk to my kindergarten daughter, please. I hear it in the morning. I don't want to go to school.
So in any aggregate, you know, and I'm generalizing, I believe that, you know, elementary students, they actually enjoy engaging with their peers and being able to take advantage of those social supports and those educational activities. Oftentimes, it's barriers that prevent families from being able. It's not necessarily the young person's motivation that prevents them from attending school, especially within K-3. Oftentimes, it's barriers that extend to the family. Mothers that may not have that may need to be at work early. There's a number of different factors, and I know the city school district has looked at those barriers and quantified them in such a way that we can look at the appropriate interventions for how to intervene.
Okay. Jack, you want something to add there? Go ahead.
Well, the only other thing I would add is that if the message that we are sending as a community is attendance matters and it helps your child academically, one of the things that I see in terms of this improvement is that more of that message is being absorbed by the community, so that parents are making a more concerted effort to make sure that their students are actually getting to school. We could do better, but that's a tremendous accomplishment.
I love throwing data questions at Erica that she might not be able to answer, but I'll just ask anyway here, because district-wide, and we're going to get to your phone calls in just a second. I see our phones are ringing now. K through 12 still has, even though it's declined from 38% to 35%, that's more than a third of students chronically absent district-wide. I have no idea how that compares to urban schools across the country. I would suspect, though, that should still be a very troubling number. That's a big number.
I don't think anybody would argue with you that all of these numbers are too high, certainly in the elementary schools, certainly in the high schools where we always have more problems with attendance. Right. So absolutely there needs to be more work done. And I would also guess, although I haven't looked this up, that Rochester is probably not too different from many urban schools. Maybe a bit worse. I don't know. Leonard, maybe you've looked at those.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Let me go ahead and get some of your phone calls in on some of these subjects as we continue working our way through the Rock the Future report card for 2015. This is Keith in Pittsford. Go ahead, Keith.
I have an interesting show. Sorry if the Bluetooth sounds bad.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
I've got a quick question. Does the school district keep track of the families behind each child? So going into the year, you have child A has a mom and dad. Mom stays home, dad works. And child B lives with her grandparents, et cetera, et cetera. So within the school year, you start to get a picture of who's missing class time, because then you might be able to understand why they're missing. So in other words, if a child's living with a grandparent,
or a single parent,
might need help to eliminate the child missing school. Or if the mom's a single parent and has to go to work, it might make a reason why, again, the child's not in school.
Keith, it's a good question. Thanks for the phone call. So do we know the breakdown of the demographics behind the kids missing school?
Not specifically. I think the district probably. I think that's been a big part of the whole effort that Leonard described, is getting to the reasons why kids are missing school. But in terms of the specifics of how kids break down, I don't know that.
Go ahead, Jackie.
Well, one of the other things that happens in terms of those attendance blitzes is that the volunteers that go out to speak to parents and family members also bring with them a packet of information with resources and supports that when a parent identifies an issue that they are having, that we are ready to provide some information and make a connection where we can. And, you know, that's been helpful.
Okay. The assumption is that a majority of kids who are chronically absent would have something less than a two-parent household at home. Jackie, is that probably a fair assumption?
I would say it's a fair assumption.
Yeah.
I mean, overall in our city, the rate of single-parent families is very, very high.
Yeah.
So just if it was equal to the overall rate, it would be really high.
Okay. Good question there, Keith. Gloria in Canandaigua next up. Go ahead, Gloria.
Hi. I just turned on the program. Your programs are always great.
Thank you. Thank you, Gloria. We have no relation, by the way. I've never met Gloria. Go ahead.
The food that children are eating, is that an emphasis at all? I happen to see, and I can't even remember from where, you know, children in a lower-income area getting a whole bit of information and food about vegetables and about fruits and eating those things and staying away from sugar and, you know, so, and it was really, really sweet. The kids are going, I love vegetables.
Well,
you know, which was just really sweet. And it's so important to physical brain development, you know, to be eating
sure.
the right thing.
Sure.
And I'm wondering, is there any emphasis on that?
Yeah. And I always think, Gloria, thank you for the phone call and the question. I always think of nutrition for kids, especially in districts with a lot of poverty, is two big issues. Number one, obviously the kids who are not getting enough to eat at home to begin with. And number two, kids who are eating but not eating healthily. So, Jackie, you want to start with an answer to Gloria's question?
excuse me. We have several community partners that are actually working on that, and that is a big issue. Food Link, I would point to Food Link and the work that they do, especially around food insecurity for children and families, and also the Greater Rochester Health Foundation and the work that they do around making sure that young people are physically fit or they know about nutrition and how those things go hand in hand, and doing some of the work that they are doing with specifically at targeted schools. So lots of work is going on around that.
How about in the schools? How about when kids show up at school, are we making sure, hey, did you have breakfast? Did you have a meal this morning? Can we help you there?
Yes, there's been a significant push on behalf of the city school district to ensure that young people are, that they have healthy meals. So I know there's been some stuff taken out. I know vending machines and things of that nature have actually been taken out of the schools. And I know that there is a stronger emphasis on the greens, the veggies and fruits that are offered. But there's two challenges that came up in my observations in the past. One is the availability, but also the utilization. So, so there has to be an education to meet the needs of the students as it relates to the healthy foods that are available. And that's not to say that they're not taking full advantage, but it's something that goes hand in hand. So it's making the food available and also the education as it relates to why it's important to eat healthy meals.
Of all the criticism of the people in the White House, and there will always be, no matter who's in the White House, there will be criticism. I have never understood the criticism of Michelle Obama for her healthy eating and what she tries to do in schools. Do you understand that, Leonard? Every time we talk about it on this program, somebody's emailing me saying she just wants to tell kids what they have to eat, and she's going to take cookies out of your kids' hand. I don't understand that at all. Do you?
I'm like you, Evan. I don't understand either.
You know, Gloria's right. This is a very, very important issue. And Gloria, I will just tell you, since we don't have someone who's really directly in charge of RCSD on that program, we haven't talked about that specifically on the show before, and we will. So thanks for the idea there. Let's get a short break in. We're going to come back, and we're going to work through some of the rest of the report card. English scores, math, high school graduation rate. There's a little bit of an uptick there. College and career ready, not an uptick there. So we're going to keep working through the Rock the Future report card for 2015 with our guests. The Alliance Director of Rock the Future, Jackie Campbell's here, Leonard Brock from the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, and Erica Rosenberg, a principal with the Center for Governmental Research, working through the numbers and the stories they tell. That's next. I'm Evan Dawson, Thursday on The Next Connections. As we head toward the cold winter months, what's being done to help our homeless population? We'll talk to various organizations about the space and support that should be available for our homeless population this winter. Then second hour, Dennis Parker, the director of the Racial Justice Program for the National ACLU, is in town. He joins us. At second hour, we'll talk with you on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I got a D in chemistry my senior year of high school.
Confessions.
And there's a reason I'm telling this story. Sometimes a grade on a report card is without context, you don't always know exactly what it means, which is why, first of all, I appreciate the fact that when we look at numbers, whether it's prenatal care for moms, enrolled in pre-K, ready for school, English grades, math grades, you're not only getting the 2015 report card, the score, that number, you can compare it to history, and then you can work through some of what it means. My D in chemistry was... It was deserved. I could have worked harder. I was shocked about it. This shocked into action, but I could not go home to my mother and father and say, "Yes, that is not representative of the effort." But sometimes it is. I've also worked very hard in some classes and ended up with grades that weren't as good as I would have hoped, but the effort was there. So sometimes we need more context. And Jackie Campbell, during a brief break, was bringing up the fact that what you at Rock the Future are doing are not only providing this look at the front of the card, but also some context. What do you want people to know?
Well, there's a couple of things about the actual report card. Even that we are doing a report card is an achievement in and of itself. So one of the things that we want to make sure that we are pushing is how well our children are doing overall. And so if we have a problem, it doesn't get better when we don't report on these numbers. So this is a great achievement. And I think it has folks looking in the right direction, how well our kids are doing. The other thing is that with respect to most of these indicators, what we are looking at is what we want for our children instead of what we don't want for our children. And so we know we have a ways to go, but as a community, we have said we have prioritized these and are looking at them and are using data and evidence to improve what we are doing so that we're improving our outcomes. So the numbers are some of the numbers are low, and we knew that they were going to be. But as a community, we're moving forward and looking at how we can actually do better. And that's a huge accomplishment in and of itself.
Jackie, where would you send people to not only check this out, but kind of read a little bit more about what is being done?
Well, two places. Actually, we have a website, rockthefuture.org, where they can get more information about Rock the Future and the initiative. And as well as the ACT Rochester website, where it has more information about some of our other indicators. So these are just the ones that we are reporting on to the community. But there are 40 some measures that folks can look at and see how well our community is doing as it relates to our children. So I would encourage them to do that. It's www.actrochester.org/rock-the-future.
Okay. Back to the report card. And the scores are not, they're not good. And so I'm just going to kind of do these in a block because we haven't seen a whole lot of change, but I'm sure our guests will be able to help illuminate some of this. English in third grade, passing state standards is my assumption, right? So we're passing state standards. Third grade English, 6% in 2013, 5% last year, 7% this year. That looks like statistical noise, Erica. That just looks like it is a very, very low number every year, right around that number.
I would agree. Yep.
Math in fourth grade, 6% 2 years ago, 12% last year, but back down to 9% passing fourth grade math this year. English in eighth grade, 6% in 2013, 6% in 2014, 4% in the latest number. That's eighth grade English. Math in eighth grade. Eighth grade math, 4% 2 years ago, up to 8% last year, down to 1% this year. Is there something I should know about 1%?
Well, some kids don't take the eighth grade math test. They take Regents instead. They take a Regents course in eighth grade, and they take the Regents math test. So they're not included in the numerator or the denominator of the equation. But just, yeah, it is important to know that because it really is a substantial amount of kids in every district.
Okay. So let's set that one aside then. Mm-hmm. But eighth grade English, 4% are passing. Fourth grade math, 9% are passing. Third grade English, 7% are passing. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned about all of them. Third grade English, 7% passing. I don't know if there's one that stands out to me. Jackie Campbell, is there any one of those numbers? Are they all equally important? I think about the third grade passage numbers. I've heard throughout history that's so important. What do you say about that?
That's a number that's concerning to us. And we are doing what we can. There's a lot of focus on third grade literacy. And so this actual test is one measure of how well kids are doing. And there are other things that are going on to improve literacy in the third grade. And we have some work to do. We know that. We are, you know, I wouldn't, you know, Erica's cautioned me for saying statistically incorrect things.
I'm sure I've already done it.
But we have a lot of work to do in this particular grade. And this is why, as I mentioned earlier, that the work that we're doing in pre-K is so important, because we're working with those children right now so that when they get to that place, that they will be much better prepared to learn.
I am fascinated where we're going to be in 2020 and 2025. Erica?
I just want to jump in and give the caveat about the state tests. You know, these are really the state tests that we're probably, I don't want to go too far out on a limb, but going to throw out in the next year or two. I mean, Governor Cuomo, we've got numerous task force now. We had a movement that was very strong statewide last year. I don't have to remind you of it.
Of course.
Of parents and educators who wanted to opt out of these tests. I mean, there's a strong feeling, if not fact, that the tests are not accurate benchmarks, are not fair benchmarks of what kids know. And I'm not really saying one way or the other, you know, whether I think that's true. But I also just want to point out that in the county, on the third grade English exam, only 30% of kids are passing countywide.
Okay.
So that's including kids in all the very well-off suburban districts, as well as, you know, more middle-of-the-road suburban districts. Only 30% of those kids are able to pass this particular assessment.
But when it comes to how the numbers are reported, Erica, let's say you've got a district where 50% opt out. Let's just pick a number. So let's say it's 50%. And then let's say the 50% who take the test, 100% of them pass. What does the district get, a 50% passage number or 100%?
100%.
Because it's
passing,
of the kids who
passing
took it.
Rate is always divided by the number tested,
okay,
not the number enrolled.
That's
correct.
That's what I thought.
Now, the state did release some data on the opt-out population and how they did on the assessments last year. So you can actually, if you feel like delving in, go see that data for every district in the state. And I will just let you know that we checked that out for the city of Rochester, and there was a smaller percentage relative to other places in the state of kids who opted out. I think it was about 15% that opted out of English language arts. They did not score all that well in 2014. So I don't think the opt-out movement is actually dragging these numbers down. I don't think it's having much of an impact.
Okay. All right. So...
But I did want to offer that overall caveat about the test.
Sure. It's a lot of good context, but it doesn't change the fact. Well, look, that context is important. I'm not going to deny that. But Leonard Brockett, I think the bigger picture remains that third grade, fourth grade, eighth grade, our kids need to be better positioned in these subjects.
Without question. We have a huge problem with respect to academic performance within the city of Rochester. And one of the reasons why Rock the Future was founded was on the precept that we need to do something as a community to respond to this crisis. I have said some very strong words in the past that we have a cultural genocide taking place, because young people, if they're not equipped with the requisite skills to not only gain employment but maintain employment, we're really going to have a dire picture in Rochester, for which we will have to address. And that's the uniquity of the work I'm doing now with the Anti-Poverty Initiative, because poverty and education work hand in glove. That's not to say causation. Poverty is not the cause for the educational challenges and vice versa, but the two work hand in glove. The one thing I will say is, because oftentimes when you look at these numbers, many people subscribe to the notion that nothing can be done. But when you look at high poverty school districts like Union City, New Jersey, and then when you look at and benchmark the work of other communities that have embraced the collective impact model, such as Strive in Cincinnati and Kentucky, there's been some work that has allowed those districts to improve. And they have very comparable school district to Rochester and some of the same challenges that we face here locally as well. So there is promise. There is an opportunity that this and the work that we're doing now could lead to positive change and positive gains. And hopefully we will see that, you know, in the years to come.
I've heard Cincinnati brought up several times, Leonard. Is that one that that we can kind of look to for some guidance, as you say?
I think Cincinnati comes up primarily because that's the city school district that actually founded Strive Together, which is quoted for leading one of the collective impact models. I would turn our attention to Union City, New Jersey. which is a school district that was able to do a significant amount of work within 13 years. And again, this is not something that happened overnight. Even when you go back to Cincinnati, it was 7 years before they actually started to see positive gains. So it takes time. We have to show community grit or resilience. But I would direct our attention to Union City, New Jersey, because they had a very comparable school district to Rochester. And now they want to say they're hovering above 80% graduation rate, and their poverty levels are consistent with the graduation rate over 80%. And there's a book, Improbable Scholars, that David Kirk, that he wrote, and there's also a few articles that he written in the New York Times that I would direct the reader's attention to.
I'll mention to our producer, Megan Mack. Let's flag that. Union City, New Jersey?
Union City, New Jersey.
Union City, and maybe we'll study up on Cincinnati and elsewhere. It's always interesting to see what else is going on around the country, and it's encouraging to hear that the people at the head of these efforts to help our kids, to help poverty, are really studying that, looking around. Stephen on Twitter wants to know, has there been any change in the definition of what poverty is in recent years? Statistics can be misleading. Well, he's right that statistics can be misleading. But let's go back to the fact that 15 years ago, 38% of children in Rochester were listed living in poverty. 55% now. The national average is 22%. So, Erica, any concern about change in definition there?
I mean, the thresholds that are set around the poverty level vary based on family size, and they are adjusted upward a little bit every year based on inflation. What most people who study this believe is that, you know, poverty really represents a pretty low when it comes to looking at how well families can provide for themselves and their children. If we think about what's necessary to really kind of make it in our community, getting right above the poverty level isn't that. You know, when we look at the costs that families incur and what they need to make to really cover those costs, it's closer to about double the poverty level.
Right.
So the poverty level, in many expert opinions, really is a pretty low benchmark.
Yeah, a lot worse. So essentially saying it's a lot worse than what's reported.
Right.
All right, Jane in Rochester, next up. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, your statistics on English really concern me, and it saddens me because I feel like English is the bridge to everything else, or languages, speaking, reading, thinking. And I'm wondering what the children do when they leave school and go home. They do something with their time, and it's obviously not something that contributes to improving the way you speak, how much you read, how well you think. English, getting that down. So what is it that the panel thinks the children are doing or not doing that would make a difference? Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Well, in terms of children leaving school and going home, you know, we have a network of providers that support their academic development as well as youth development, working with them in school programs, after school programs, as well as in the community. So some of those providers are also providing support for their academic enrichment that supports their growth in literacy. But the other thing that I would point out in terms from the Rock Their Future perspective, there is also a role for the entire community and in particularly families in this work. Mm-hmm. And so supporting families to support the literacy development of their children at home, there's a lot of things that can actually be done. One of the criticisms that I would level at Rochester as a community, with the understanding that I was involved in the community in a leadership role, is that we know what the research says and what the data says and know what are some strategies that we can do to improve, but we kind of hoard the information so that professionals know it and do it. But there are some community-based strategies that can help young people improve when they go to school, and we need to be also doing that. And that's one of the target areas for Rock the Future this coming year, is to embrace parents. And, you know, parents, they want to do this work too. I was approached very early on. I've been in my role now for, this is my sixth week. And with 2 weeks in, I met with some parent leaders and, you know, what is Rock the Future? What are you all doing? And how can we help? You know, first we want to understand it, but we also want to help because these are our kids. I had a one of the co-chairs of the city school district's parent advisory council said something, and I've been quoting it. And so she has two children in the district, but she says, you know, in reality, I have 30,000 kids. And that's the commitment that our parents are bringing. And so we should embrace that and support them in being able to do that.
And Jackie, on the question of getting involved, I want to refer not only to a listener's comment on Twitter, but also a conversation we had on this program on Monday. We had a conversation about revitalizing different neighborhoods, you know, from 19th Ward to Josanna to all these different things that are happening in different places. And Louis Aponte was one of our guests who said, you know, for years, there were well-intentioned efforts that tended to fall flat in city neighborhoods, and they tended to be one of two things. Some kind of a grant that ran out, so you know, let's do this for a little while, and then the money's gone, and then whatever's happening stops. Or well-intended people who did not live in the city, who would come in and dictate to neighbors on what they should do instead of coming in to listen. And he said, now what you're seeing is a lot of mobilization of saying, this neighborhood, wherever it is not getting better if the neighbors are not involved.
Right.
And so we're listening more. And I thought that was very interesting. And so it makes it harder, I think, for people who don't live in the city, might live in the suburbs, but care to figure out what they can do, but we don't want to say there's nothing they can do. Here's Joe on Twitter. Living in Parma, I feel disconnected from the city, even though I care about our community. Mm-hmm. What can suburbanites do to help? Jackie, Leonard, what do you say to that?
Well, from the Rock to Future perspective, there are volunteer opportunities. And in particular, I will say the attendance strategy from the city school district. We need volunteers to actually go out and engage families. And one of the things that the parent leaders informed me was that they want to go out and talk to families, too, that they would have a closer relationship and some context. But that's a huge opportunity to partner folks who are from outside of the community with parents who are actually inside the community to be engaged in this work. We also have some opportunities for the financial aid efforts that are happening around encouraging students to apply for college and motivating them to actually do that. So there's a role for folks who are wanting to participate.
Have they got in touch with you guys?
Well,
you find some work for them? Leonard, Jackie?
So I can speak to the fundamental shift that's required. I think the question was somewhat two-pronged. What are the opportunities specifically that a person could volunteer? And if you are an outside person, and then again, there's this resistance because you're an outside person looking to direct how the community organize around what's necessary to improve their community, there's two things that has to happen. One, there has to be work with the community and not on behalf of. So a lot of the resistance is because fundamentally, we believe that we, and I say we, and that's a general sense of the word, we believe what's best for others. So we see individuals in a situation for which they need improvement, as opposed to involving or engaging their voice, we want to tell them what they need to do and how they can do it because we don't necessarily value the input that they can bring for whatever reason. So that's a fundamental shift that's required. The second is we have to look for opportunities to support neighborhoods in the absence of resources. So the alignment, coordination of existing supports and existing resources and tapping into those assets that currently exist is something that we don't do a really good job at. We are contingent upon outside resources as well as outside supports, when in reality there is much in the community that we could build up if we were to direct our attention there.
All right, let me get back to the report card because we got a few more categories to get through. The 2015 Rock the Future report card, high school graduation, 49% in 2013, 48% last year, 51% is the newest number for Rochester City School District high school graduation. I assume that's not four-year. Is that correct? I think I could be wrong. I always thought the four-year rate was closer to 40, low 40.
No, that is four-year.
It is four-year?
Yeah, we go out to August of the year for kids that had to make up a course over the summer or something, but it is the four-year rate.
Okay, so
51%. So if you look at a five-year rate, it's a little bit higher.
Okay, so 51% from 48. Is that statistical noise, or is that enough to say that there's something going on, Erica?
Well, I'm going to be supportive and say we're moving in the right direction.
Is it possible that it's statistical noise?
Of course, but we hope not.
Okay. Jackie, when you see 51%, we're over that number. It's nice to see a 5 in front of that number, I will say that.
Over the half mark, right?
Well, boy, it's been a long road. And
you know what, can I say a word about that too again? Hate to be the context queen here, but these are not large gains, they're small gains, but they did happen over the last decade while we've put higher standards in place. I mean, it's been a few years back now, but remember, all kids have to pass Regents. We let them pass at 55 for a while. Now it's up to 65. So it's some degree
it's
of accomplishment. That's right.
Harder to pass.
Yeah.
All right, Jackie, 51%. No one wants it to stay there. But what are we thinking right now for the high school graduation, right? I mean, if we accept that it's a small uptick, but maybe going in a good direction, what continues to put us in a better direction?
I think that there's some work that we can do at the younger end of the spectrum. We tend to focus on how many kids are graduating. And so we have some data that shows that some kids enter the ninth grade needing some support. And so how do we also provide some of that emphasis? We're not just looking at, you know, if you graduated, but what are the measures that show that young people are moving towards in the right direction? And looking at the number of credits a student has and making sure that we're providing opportunities for credit recovery so that they can graduate on time is one of those strategies. And so what this helps us to do is to say, okay, this is where we are. What do we want to do to make this better? And we have some data and evidence that will inform our practice around that.
All right, but here's where I get pessimistic. If it's harder to graduate now, harder to pass, mm-hmm. and we've seen a small uptick, so it's 51%, but if it was 10 years ago, it would probably be less because kids would be struggling in certain ways now with the standards, if the standards were the same 10 years ago. So 51%. But look at the next one, college and career ready. Maybe there's a contextual point that I'm mm-hmm. missing here, but 2 years ago, 2013, college and career ready, only 36%, but that fell to 23% in 2014, and the 2015 report card number for college and career ready is 18%. Mm-hmm. Erica, is there any context I'm really missing there?
Just to mention that these are the kids from the school district who are going to MCC, so kids who are going to other colleges who might be better prepared are not included in this number, but certainly of the share of kids who are going to MCC, the college readiness level has gone down, and it's disturbing.
Okay. Leonard, you've been part of this for a while now. That number at 18%, what do you make of it?
It's something that we need to improve because when you look at the sustainability or the retention of college students, even beyond the first year in college, there's a certain level of attrition that you would expect.
And, good point.
And so there's work to do. There's work to do on both ends of the spectrum. And I'm glad that we're focused from cradle to career. There's a significant amount of work that we have to do, and this certainly points to a problem and a disconnect and one that we need to address as a community. For
yeah,
sure.
And just to amplify that point, I'm sorry, but, you know, kids who didn't get what they needed in high school, now they're going to college. Now they have to pay for it. Now they're paying for these courses, and as Leonard alluded to, it really increases the chances that they're not going to finish and they might not make it even to that second year.
Right. And the only other thing I would add is that there is some work being done to get what the actual number is, so including some of our graduates who end up at RIT and U of R, mm-hmm. and really looking at across the spectrum, not just at one institution, how are our young people doing?
Okay. You know, there is a part of me that thinks, I wish we could fast forward 20 years because we'll know if what's going on is working. And right now, the community's got to trust. That's why Leonard's got such a hard job. Jackie's got a hard job. And Erica just does the data. But the
That's easy.
Leonard's got such an important job leading this anti-poverty initiative. And in many ways, we feel like we've got to be right here. We've got to diagnose this. We're not going to wipe out poverty. It doesn't but we've got to find a way to not be the city in its size in this country that leads in child poverty and in extreme poverty and in concentrated poverty. And it is going to take time. I mean, I know people are impatient.
Yes.
But I do have excitement that 10, 20 years from now, what we're seeing with prenatal care, higher than it's ever been, enrolled in pre-K, nearly universal now. I have to believe that we're going in a good direction. But I want to ask you a question that I haven't asked before, which is throughout the summer, the spring, the summer, when we're getting ready for the Anti-Poverty Initiative, a lot of the workshops were happening. I wondered, whatever comes out of this, some of it's going to be hard, right? I mean, it's not like it's easy to get out of poverty.
Right.
What's the first thing that what's one example of something that will be hard. And I don't know if that means hard for politicians to get their heads around in terms of policy or for the community to do. What's the first thing that you say, this is not going to be easy, but we're starting to see that we have to find a way to do this?
I think there are a number of things that are difficult and challenging to do, but I will direct the attention to one of the hardest things that we had to confront. And as a community, I'm glad that we're having the conversation around structural racism and policies and practices that promote racial inequity. So for us to put that on the floor and say this is something that we need to address now is not an easy feat. It's
I
not something that
couldn't
easy.
Agree more. That's right. That is a great example. But let's be. What's one specific example where structural racism is hurting us?
There are housing policies. You have workforce practices that prevent people from having access to quality opportunities. But let me back up a minute.
Sure.
The creation of a system of social supports, getting everyone to row in the same direction, to partner, work together, and collaborate in a much more meaningful way is easier said than done. So when you think about the mutually reinforcing activities and the creation of a system for which you have an educational system that may plug into it, or a DHS system, or a healthcare system that plugs into it, where young people or families could receive the necessary supports to mobilize out of poverty, how you do that is going to be a very challenging task. But I'm glad that we're partnering with IBM to create the design principles for what a new system would and could be. So that's one of the many challenges, because this work is not easy. It's multimodal and is definitely going to require years. The second thing from a fundamental perspective that makes the work challenging is the fact that we do have to show institutional grit. We tell young people in school districts that, you know what, you have to be resilient. But as a community, we don't see change in the first year or two. We throw out the baby with the bathwater. And then we come back 5 years later and try to repeat the same process. Mm-hmm. So the hardest thing to do is to convince the community that this is going to take time and to continue to ensure that everyone is engaged, because one person, one initiative, or one organization can't respond to poverty. It's going to require the entire community. So the hardest thing to do is to ensure that our stick-wittedness.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't agree more, because I hope that, because there will be political leaders that change
right
over the next
Absolutely.
5, 10, 20 years. And somehow this community has got to decide what comes out of this initiative
right.
and rock the future. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be work that doesn't get started over and scrapped every 2 or 3 years.
Absolutely.
Like Leonard
Absolutely.
Said.
And Absolutely.
You have a very hard job of that. But right. but I appreciate you being here and continuing to update us. Jackie, as we get ready to go, let our listeners know one more time where they can find the report card and read more about the goals and what's coming out of it.
The ACT Rochester website, www.actrochester.org/rockthefuture.
Rock the Future report card. Thank you. Nice to see you here. We'll continue our conversation.
Absolutely.
It's great to have you. Erica Rosenberg, CGR, thank you.
Thank you.
And Leonard, thank you.
Thank you.
Always good conversation. Thanks for
Thanks.
All the great feedback from our audience today in various forms. Val LaBanca, the engineer of this program, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections on Member-Supported Public Radio.